We've lost our audience. I thought this was really interesting. I do think this is interesting. Our whole team thinks it's very interesting. Okay, well.
The court now resumes its session.
Thank you, Lewis. Look, I want to, at the outset of part two here, I'd like to welcome two important guests to the courtroom. We have with us let me start with this. This is my senior law clerk, Bridget Golub's last oral argument before she deserts me. She is extraordinary. She has provided unbelievably insightful legal counsel to me through these last almost 2 years. I can't believe it's been 2 years. Not only the quality of your work, but your presence will be greatly missed when you move on. And to commemorate the occasion, we have Bridget's husband, Graham McConnell, and we have Bridget's mother, Monique Golub, here with us. And I understand, Ms. Golub, that this might be an unusually important day. Well, congratulations on 29th birthday, and we are thrilled to. You're Bridget's mother or her sister? Trying to figure. Okay. So part two, if we can start with part two. If I can start, Ms. Bay, I'm going to start the first question off with you. Can we do parts one and two questions one and two under Roman numeral two to start, and may I ask if you have any comments on those?
Sure, I will take one and two. I'll start with one. We don't read 16 USC 2442 when it says nothing in this chapter shall be construed as contravening or superseding the provisions of any statute, which may otherwise apply to Antarctic marine living resources, as encompassing general jurisdictional statutes like 28 USC 1581. The key language is which may otherwise apply to Antarctic marine living resources. 1581 is not a statute about AMLR, rather it's a statute outlining the contours of this court's jurisdiction. And I don't think it would be reasonable to read 2442A as incorporating any statute that could ever conceivably apply to Atlantic marine living resources under any situation whatsoever. By that logic, then, you know, the statute that applies to trademarks and patents could conceivably apply to Atlantic marine living resources. I think that the statute was meant to apply to other statutes that directly, or at least less tenuously, apply to the actual creatures at hand, like other environmental statutes, for example, maybe the Endangered Species Act or another act that has to do with Antarctica. And I looked through the legislative history. There's no direct statements from Congress on this, but I did find a hearing transcript where the State Department sort of agreed with that, meaning that this statute wouldn't supersede other statutes that had to do with the same area of coverage, but would rather just supplement it and add new things to it. And so we just don't think it's a reasonable reading to have 2442A refer to generalized statutes like 1581. So we don't think it affects it.
May I press you on that for a moment?
Sure.
What was the State Department document that you were mentioning that gave you this context?
Let me just pull it up. There was a hearing transcript. Let me find it right quickly on my computer. Sorry about this. The document is hearing on the Subcommittee on Fisheries and Wildlife Conservation. So a House hearing that predated the MLARCA, and it's serial number 98-24, should anyone want to reference it at some point. And on page 33 of that document, the State Department submitted a submission in response to a request from the House, and it states that the act, particularly through what eventually became Section 2442, establishes the appropriate relationship between the convention and existing treaties and statutes. In particular, the act is not intended to supersede the International Whaling Convention, is not intended to supersede the Antarctic Conservation Act, and it lists a couple other statutes that also have to do with a similar subject area that MLARCA is not intended to supersede. So we read 2442 as basically not trying to tread on ground that's already been tread on or supersede these acts that were already in place that had to do with similar geographic areas or similar animals. We don't read it to, again, extend to something like a general jurisdictional statute that could conceivably cover any subject area or any product or creature under the sun.
Got it. Okay. Mr. Lau.
Thank you, Your Honor. So we did not identify Section 2442.
Can you lean a little in?
This provision, regrettably, we did not identify. Whoever identified it should be applauded for thorough legal research. This is the type of forward thinking that will take anyone long in a legal career. I believe that this statute is dispositive. It resolves any purported conflict between 2440 and 1581I. I believe that statute is clear on its face. With that in mind, the Customs Courts Act of 1980 does precede November 8, 1984. And 1581I, if it would otherwise apply to Antarctic marine living resources, and here's how, because if we didn't have to deal with 2435 or any other part of the MLARCA, then there would be no question but that this case belongs within the purview of the Court of International Trade. There's nothing in the statute that states that it does not encompass general jurisdictional statutes. That is a gloss on the statute that Ms. Bay is making that can't be reconciled with the plain meaning of the language itself. The statement referenced by at a hearing apparently by a State Department official, it is the view of one member of the administration. And that is a very, very weak form of legislative history. And the court should not give any weight to that statement by the State Department official whatsoever. Rather, the court should give full meaning to the plain meaning of 2442.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Bay. Yes?
I just want to say, looking at the plain meaning of 2442, it states it may otherwise apply to Antarctic marine living resources. And if you're looking at the plain meanings of the statutes, 1581 plainly does not apply to Atlantic marine living resources.
Clear answers, as you've been giving all morning. And I express appreciation. let's move on to question three. Ms. Bay, I'm going to start again with
Want to skip? I don't think I actually got to question two. I didn't know.
Threw question two along with question one, but if you have separate comments on that, you're most welcome.
I don't really have that much else to say other than I don't think you can read 2435 as creating an exception to subsection three of it. I think you have to read it all together. And so you can't really distinguish it from as something other than, I don't think you can distinguish it to exclude embargoes or quantitative restrictions, but that's the only additional thing I had to say on that. So I can move to question three, or Mr. Lau can respond.
Mr. Lau, did you have anything on question two?
Yes, Your Honor.
Please.
Very quickly. Remember earlier I mentioned the Orleans case and the Beef Act, and there were numerous possible causes of action under the Beef Act, only one of which would go to the Court of International Trade. 2435.3 is a good example of this principle, because there are a number of activities that are unlawful to ship, transport, offer for sale, purchase. Those activities fall outside the purview of this court's exclusive jurisdiction. The next phrase, import, that is, that would fall within the purview of the CIT's jurisdiction. But the other activities, export, have custody, possession, or control, those would be other actions that would have to go to a district court. And again, this result, it's contemplated by, it's consistent with the statutory scheme. This is exactly what the Federal Circuit said in Orleans is to be expected. So those are my comments on that.
Okay, thank you for that. I think you were saying something earlier about who does the legal work around here. It's
understood.
The rest of them do a lot of work, just not on this, well, exceptional work, just not on this particular case. May I ask, before we leave question two, is it your view that 2442 and 2435 offer context for the jurisdictional question under 2440?
Absolutely. Either. Yes, Your Honor, I do.
You say yes. Ms. Bay?
I do not think that 2435 offers context for 2440 other than to say that everything in 2435 is captured by the district court's exclusive jurisdiction under 2440.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so moving on to question three, Ms. Bay, if I can ask you, we've talked about Orleans and Vivitar, but if we can ask you, of course you've briefed on them, but if you could answer the question.
Yes, so I'll just talk about Vivitar and Orleans in the context of congressional intent, and this actually segues nicely to a point that Mr. Lau made regarding the Beef Act, which I think is incredibly distinguishable from 2435. In the Beef Act, the key here was that the Federal Circuit in Orleans found that Congress explicitly did not intend to give the district courts jurisdiction over every type of Beef Act action. And they found so because the Beef Act statute, which is 7 U.S.C. 2908, specifically says that the district courts have jurisdiction specifically to enforce and to prevent and restraining a person from violating an order or regulation. So given that very specific language, the Federal Circuit found that the Beef Act was only giving jurisdiction to enforce and prevent and restrain people from violating an order or regulation, and therefore Congress did not intend to give the district courts jurisdiction over every type of action arising out of the Beef Act. 2440, on the other hand, is almost broad in the opposite way. 2440 specifically states that the district courts shall have exclusive jurisdiction over any case or controversy arising under the provisions of this chapter. So that includes every single aspect of 2435. So I think if you look at congressional intent, Congress's intent is expressed through the specific statutory language of Section 2908 or the Beef Act and Section 2440. I think that difference is extremely stark and telling. With regard to Vivitar, I think the issue is a bit different, but still touches on congressional intent. The interesting thing about Vivitar is that the court's reasoning that you should look at CIT jurisdiction before district jurisdiction was because the district court jurisdiction at hand had to do with the general federal question jurisdiction set out in 28 U.S.C. 1338. And so you had to look at the CIT jurisdiction before looking at district jurisdiction. Otherwise, it would negate the intent of Congress in granting jurisdiction over certain matters to the CIT because 1331, I said 1338, but I meant 1331, would otherwise subsume the CIT's jurisdiction in every circumstance. So that was really the nexus of the Federal Circuit's decision in Vivitar, and Vivitar found that Congress's intent would be violated if you looked at general district court jurisdiction ahead of looking at CIT jurisdiction. But the situation here is a completely different creature because it doesn't implicate the broad jurisdiction of the district court's federal question jurisdiction. Rather, it implicates a very specific grant of exclusive jurisdiction to district courts over all, but only, MLARCA-related actions. So I think, again, if you're looking at congressional intent, then congressional intent would not be violated by looking to the MLARCA jurisdictional statute along with the CIT jurisdictional statute, rather than only looking at the CIT jurisdictional statute. And I just want to make one more point before I hand it off to Mr. Lau. Well, actually, you know what? Sorry. I will hold that for the next section of discussion.
Okay. Thank you for that, Ms. May. Mr. Lau.
Thank you, Your Honor. Neither in her comments to the court today nor in the government's brief have the government effectively distinguished the crucial holdings of Orleans and Vivitar with respect to the jurisdictional question. In both decisions, the court explained that when it comes to a question of deciding the jurisdiction of this court versus the jurisdiction of the district courts, that it is, to use their language, a faulty analysis to look first at the jurisdiction of the district courts. Rather, the role of this court is to look solely at whether the claim falls within the language and intent of the jurisdiction granted to this court. Sometimes parties use the word precedent loosely and inappropriately. I believe this is precedent because it's not some sort of random statement made in a footnote by a Federal Circuit opinion. Rather, this is now the Federal Circuit stating twice, clearly, unequivocally, how it is a faulty analysis to look to the jurisdiction of the district courts, rather look solely at the jurisdiction of this court. I understand the meaning of the word faulty. I certainly understand the meaning of the word solely. And I believe it is very fair to say that the statements that we rely upon in Orleans and Vivitar are precedent. And I believe that this court should honor that precedent, even if the court would view the issue differently if presented as a question of first impression. I think it is I'll use this phrase as gently as I can. I think it is the obligation of this court to give meaning to the Federal Circuit's precedent. And that means in this instance to disregard the jurisdictional grants of MLARCA and to look solely within the four corners of 1581. Now, your question had a separate aspect to it. What does this mean for legislative history? Following the rule of Orleans and Vivitar, following the precedent, do you look at the legislative history of MLARCA, that 1984 Act? No, that would be a faulty analysis. Alternatively, should this court look to the legislative history behind the Custom Courts Act of 1980? Yes, exactly. And that is entirely appropriate because that legislative history confirms why Congress decided to expand the jurisdiction of this court, to add clarity to those decisions those cases that should go to this court or the district court. It also added certainty about this idea about the specialized expertise that this court has in 1581. And on this point, and this will be my final point, I know there was a debate in the briefing about whether 1581 is more specific or whether MLARCA is more specific. Orleans also provides the answer. Why do I say this? Because if we look at page 1378 of that decision, the Federal Circuit states as follows, quote, section 1581I removes specific actions from the general federal question jurisdiction of the district courts under 28 U.S.C. 1331 and places them in the jurisdiction of the Court of International Trade. So that's another reflection about what's more specialized, 1581 or those other jurisdictional grants. It's 1581, Your Honor. Those are my comments on that question.
In your quotation, it mentions 1331, though. But Ms. Bay was seeking to distinguish 1331 on the grounds that it's obviously a very, very fundamental and broad grant of authority to the district courts, whereas in the context of MLARCA, it's a very specific grant. And that also goes to the quotation that you were offering us from Orleans.
Yes. I understand the point. This is not a 13, the government is not asserting that the district court would possess jurisdiction under 1331. I acknowledge that. However, if we follow the rule of Orleans and Vivitar, the precedent, still ignore, the court should ignore 2440. That's the faulty analysis that the Federal Circuit does not want this court to engage in. Rather, look solely at 1581I. This issue might present more difficulties had it arisen, say, in the early 1980s. But with the benefit of time, 1581 has been on the books now for, 40 plus years. And there have been numerous cases construing it, both here at the Court of International Trade, as well as the Federal Circuit. So we're not dealing with a case of first impression. We have all the tools we need before us to give full meaning to the jurisdiction of this court. And I think that when this court follows, if this court follows the precedent of the Federal Circuit, as well as the prior holdings of this court, it should comfortably conclude that this is an embargo or other quantitative restriction, and it falls within the jurisdiction under 1581.
Ms. Bay, I have a feeling you'd like
certainly.
Reply.
So I do think that you raise a very good point that Orleans says nothing about the specificity of 1581I, except with regard to the very broad jurisdictional grant of 1331. Here, on the other hand, MLARCA's jurisdictional statute 2440 is extremely specific and extremely narrow, and I don't think it's, I think it's easy to show that MLARCA is more specific, or MLARCA's jurisdictional statute is more specific than the general grant of jurisdiction in certain areas granted under Section 1581. With regard to Vivitar and Orleans and this precedent, I do think it's conspicuous that Mr. Lau does not mention one key distinguishing factor, and one that I think that, I mean, I can't speculate as to what the Federal Circuit would do if it ever got there, but that I think it would take into account, which is that in this case, 2440 gives the district courts exclusive jurisdiction. Neither in Vivitar nor Orleans did the competing jurisdictional statute give exclusive jurisdiction. And so I think that's a very big distinction that can be made. I think, as we pointed out in our reply brief, you could potentially have a district court case in a similar situation where the district court says, well, no, we should look to our exclusive jurisdiction first, and you can't have both the district court and this court both claiming exclusive jurisdiction over the same issue. So I do think you need to use and compare both statutes in this context. You can't only look at 1581I and just completely ignore the fact that 2440 also gives or also uses the term exclusive jurisdiction. And sort of related to that, I do think it's pertinent to point out again that the reason that Vivitar said that you should look to 1581 rather than looking to district court jurisdiction, that was again in the context of 1331, which is general federal jurisdiction. And I'll just follow up by saying that I think this can all be sort of dispensed with and resolved because you don't have to read the two statutes as conflicting. If you read MLARCA as not providing for an embargo, then there's no conflict at all between 2440 and 1581I because there wouldn't be any overlap. So I think that, along with our other reasoning, is a reason to find that the case is not an embargo because that would take these two statutes out of conflict with each other.
Okay.
Very quickly.
Yeah. Yes.
What if the Federal Circuit never contemplated a statute like MLARCA that had the phrase exclusive jurisdiction? How do you deal with that? And here's my quick answer. Precedent is precedent. The Federal Circuit set out a very straightforward, clear-cut rule in Orleans and Vivitar. And that is precedent. And even if this court were to conclude that the Federal Circuit might take a different view had it been presented with this statute, I think it's the role of this court to give honor and meaning to the precedent of Orleans and Vivitar, follow those instructions. If the government feels so strongly that there's something different about MLARCA that warrants a different result, let the government take an appeal at the end of the day and have the Federal Circuit resolve that question. But for the here and now, I do believe it's the role of this court, and I say this comfortably, to follow all precedential decisions of the Federal Circuit, even if the court, this court would be inclined to rule differently if it was a case of first impression. That's how I would look at that issue, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Lau. Our last question concerns, and may be able to be answered fairly briefly by each of the parties, what the court should do should the court find that it does not have jurisdiction under 1581I. Mr. Lau, with respect to transferring. Mr. Lau.
Transfer option, Your Honor. We're interested in having our proverbial day in court. We are still interested in importing two fish into the United States. We think we're right on the merits, the jurisdictional merits here, but if we lose, we would ask the court to transfer this case, and we would ask that it be transferred to the Southern District of Florida for the following reasons. We attempted to import this merchandise at Port Everglades near Fort Lauderdale, and that falls within the jurisdictional boundaries of the Southern District of Florida. So we would ask that the case be transferred to that court.
Thank you, Mr. Lau. Ms. Bay.
So a few parts to this. So first, I'd like to start placing, we wouldn't oppose, if the court decides that it doesn't have jurisdiction and if the court decides it's appropriate, we wouldn't oppose transfer of the action to the appropriate district court with a couple of caveats, of course. One is that, by not opposing, we wouldn't be waiving any other grounds for dismissal that the district court or the Environmental and Natural Resources Division, who would be taking over the case, would have. We obviously wouldn't be arguing the opposite of what we argue here, but there may be grounds we're not considering. And so we wouldn't be waiving that the district court should be able to hear the case or that the venue is improper. We don't know any reason why the district court in Florida would be an improper venue, but again, that's not something we'd be waiving by not opposing. And the only other point we would make is that, we think that there's a decent chance that the complaint would need to be amended to fit the contours of whatever they're asserting pursuant to district court jurisdiction, since this complaint was very specifically tailored to invoke this court's jurisdiction. But subject to those caveats, we wouldn't oppose transfer.
Thank you. Any other closing comments? We're done with our questions. Ms. Bay.
This is sort of changing the subject a little bit, but it just has to quickly do with the administrative record. As the court's aware, plaintiff moved to supplement the AR 2 days ago, I think. So I know we have a few weeks to respond to that, but we wanted to raise whether the court thought it made sense to reserve briefing and ruling on that until after it decides the jurisdictional question, just because if the court decides to dismiss or transfer the case, then it seems like it would be more appropriate for whichever district court might hear it to decide the question of whether the AR was complete as is or not. And then if this court keeps jurisdiction, we could address that issue at that point.
Thank you, Ms. Bain. Give me just a moment. Yes, we would like your response to Mr. Lau's motion and follow up with that as appropriate. So I have to say, I don't think I've had an oral argument that was more in the service of justice and in the work of the court than what you each have provided and your colleagues who are here today through their contributions. I'm very appreciative. I think as officers of the court, you have distinguished yourselves very highly, and I'm appreciative of that because it serves the purpose of being able to make the best possible decision about on the merits here. I'm going to also thank the exceptional team led by my senior law clerk, Bridget Golub, and my law clerk, Sybilla Grennan, and my intern, Margaret Myman, and Katie Klein, who've enabled me to do whatever I was doing here this morning. They are exceptional, and I'm very appreciative. I also want to express appreciation to all the staff of the court that enable us to be here, keep this courthouse, all our custodial staff who make sure that we sit in a very clean and safe environment, our court security officers who do a great job of making sure we are all safe and the building is taken well care of in that respect, and everybody else, including our audiovisual staff who are not seen and not heard. but make sure that Chris can join us. I think we have some folks on the phone this morning. Lewis, is that right?
Correct.
So without them, this absolutely would not happen, including your microphones and everything else about this proceeding. So we are all indebted. It takes a village, and we have a phenomenal village in this building. And I am appreciative to all of you for the work that you did this morning. It has assisted us, and we wish you a good afternoon.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
All right, the court is now in recess.